Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Yes, indeed. Shrink Wrap Radio number 243, Exploring Behavioral Economics with Dan Ariely. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The reason I think to attack economics is because of its dogmatic role in our lives. So, you know, on an intellectual basis, I would say there's no reason to attack economics. Economists can do whatever they want. Historians can do whatever they want. You know, we're in a different field. We can do whatever we want. But the fact is that economics have become the social science of choice. And not only is it influencing people in undergrad institutions, it influences people on Wall Street and people in Washington. And our legal system is basically a translation of economic theory to contracts. So I think that the reason to call our field behavioral economics is just because economics has been so successful. And I think that what we want to do is to undermine this success and bring more realistic, evidence-based, empirical observation from social science into business, policy, and everyday life.
That was the voice of my guest, Dan Ariely, speaking about behavioral economics and its challenge to traditional economic theory in practice. Dan Ariely is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, where he holds appointments at the Fuqua School of Business, the Center of Cognitive Neuroscience, the School of Medicine, and the Department of Economics. He's also a founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. In addition, Dan is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions, and The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. Using simple experiments, Dan studies how people actually act in the marketplace as opposed to how they should or would perform if they were completely rational. His interests span a wide range of daily behaviors such as buying or not, saving or not, ordering food in restaurants, pain management, procrastination, dishonesty, and decision-making under different emotional states. His experiments are consistently interesting, amusing, and informative, demonstrating profound ideas that fly in the face of common wisdom. Dan earned a bachelor's degree in psychology from Tel Aviv University, his master's and doctorate degrees in cognitive psychology from the University of North Carolina, and a doctorate in business administration from Duke University. His research has been published in leading psychology, economics, and marketing and management research journals, and has been featured occasionally in the popular press, for example, the New York Times, the New Yorker Magazine, the Washington Post, the Financial Times, and so on. He's a regular contributor to Marketplace on National Public Radio. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dan Ariely, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Well, I am thrilled to have you on the show. I was recently a presenter at a market research conference in Prague, and several of the keynote speakers there made reference to the field of behavioral economics. And I realize my own need to get up to speed with the field, so I'm really excited to have this opportunity to speak with you to deepen my own education and, of course, to share all this juicy info with my listeners.
I'll do my best. Let's see.
Okay. Well, I've been reading your most recent book, The Upside of Irrationality, and one of the things I like about it is it's very personal, and you tell lots of good stories, not only about your research, but also about your personal history and background. So let's start there. Tell us a bit about your background and how you got drawn into behavioral economics.
Yeah, so the starting point was actually kind of very, very sad in many ways. I was badly injured. I got involved in this big explosion, and about 70% of my body was badly burned. And as a consequence, I spent 3 years in hospital. And that made me a different person and made me think differently in many ways. But perhaps the most catalytic event was the debate I used to have every day with the nurses about how to remove my bandages.
Mm.
If you think about it, you know, I ask this question to lots of people. Imagine you have two strategies. Strategies one, you rip the bandages off quickly, you don't take much time, but each second is very, very painful. Strategy two, you rip them off slowly, you take lots and lots of time, but each second is not as painful. And which one of those two strategies is better? And the answer that most people give, the vast majority, as well as my nurses, is that the ripping approach is a better approach. So here I was being, you know, it was incredibly painful, and the nurses would rip my bandages, and they would do it as fast as possible, bandage after bandage, for about 45 minutes to an hour. And I would try to reason with them that, you know, maybe we should do things slower. Maybe we should take more time. Maybe they shouldn't rip just as quickly. And they basically told me that they were correct, that they knew what would minimize my pain. And they also told me that my role as a patient is not to, you know, argue and make comments. It's to basically be passive.
Right.
And when I got out of the hospital many years later, I started doing experiments on this, and I discovered that the nurses were wrong. I discovered that despite their strong intuition that they were correct, despite their belief that they were correct, they were nevertheless wrong, that this approach was actually creating more pain rather than less pain. And the thought that kind of got me started from this is that if the nurses, who are good, kind individuals, nevertheless got things wrong, are there other cases in life in which we have very strong intuition, very strong belief in something that we do repeatedly day after day with many people that has real consequences, but nevertheless we get things wrong? And that kind of got me to start thinking about behavioral economics more generally, or more precisely about the places in life where we have strong intuitions, but it's not necessarily the case that we're correct. Now, I should say one more thing about being injured. So, you know, there's a lot of specific things that happened to me in hospital that were kind of big events, traumatic, complex, difficult, that made me think about life in specific ways. But one of the most interesting things about being in hospital is that I kind of started feeling as if I was an alien. And I don't mean it in a simple sense, but imagine that all of a sudden you put on a bed for a very long time, and you don't do anything that you did in your past life, and you don't do anything that the people around you are doing. For example, for many months, I couldn't eat. I just was fed by a tube. I didn't get out of bed. I mean, I didn't. Lots of things I didn't do. And by having this separated life that is so different all of a sudden, it made me look at things very differently. So here I was living a very different life than I used to. And everybody around me was behaving in the same way. And it made me think very differently. And I think despite the fact that this was a long time ago, it was over 20 years ago, I still have maintained some of this outside perspective on life, where I think one of my advantages as an academic is that I can look at things that happen to everybody and look at them slightly as if I'm an outsider, and therefore have a slightly different perspective on them.
Okay, you know, that was a horrific experience, and maybe we'll touch on it as you do in the book. You kind of, it's sort of a touchstone that you come back to, depending upon which topic you're talking about. And so maybe we'll have occasion to do that as well as we go along. You know, I took one course in economics as an undergraduate about a million years ago, and I really hated it. I don't know if it was the content that struck me as boring or just the very boring delivery of the instructor. But this new field of behavioral economics seems like a really exciting one.
Yes, yeah, so one thing is I actually like economics. You know, I think there's kind of economic has a really beautiful theory and some really wonderful insights in it. And I you know, some people think of behavioral economics is the opposite of economics, but I think of it as actually complementary. You know, we have lots of ways to describe human behavior. We can use sociology and anthropology, and we can use philosophy, and we can use economics, and we can use psychology, of course. And all of those things are useful in describing how people are living. And none of them is perfectly correct, and none of them is perfectly wrong. And if you think about economics as being just that, it describes part of human behavior under a part of the circumstances, then you can say, hey, it's quite useful. But what has happened to economics is that instead of describing some of human behavior under some circumstances, people start using it as a prescriptive theory, saying not only economic is useful, but it's perfectly useful, it's 100% accurate, and you don't need anything else to understand how life is. And in fact, we believe it so much that we're going to start creating institutions and market and other things, assuming that economic theory is 100% correct. And that, I think, is where things really break down in magnificent, magnificent ways. So I don't want to throw economics out. I just want us to have more modest assumptions about how useful economics is and how applicable it is, rather than assuming it's perfectly correct and building the world according to it.
Yes. Now, social psychologists have always impressed me with their clever research designs. And in many ways, I could see you in that camp. As I read your book, I find myself wondering, well, what's the difference between a behavioral economist like you and a social psychologist?
So I think, you know, first of all, thanks for the compliment. You know, I love a social psychologist, and I think you're right. The cleverness and the insight into human behavior that social psychologists have, I think, are really kind of unparalleled in the social sciences. There's so much wonderful stuff
yes.
there. I think that any social psychologist could become a behavioral economist. The real issue is, are you taking economic theory on or not, right?
So yes.
Many times a psychologist, I go to present in the psychology department and I say, hey, economic theory believes that. Let's look at if this is really correct. And people say, why would you ever spend your time on that? Why would you care about economics? And I said, there's lots of wrong theories in lots of different fields. Why not attack historians or people in chemistry? Why are you so obsessed with attacking economics? And the reason I think to attack economics is because of its dogmatic role in our lives. So, you know, on an intellectual basis, I would say there's no reason to attack economics. Economists can do whatever they want. Historians can do whatever they want. You know, we're in a different field. We can do whatever we want. But the fact is that economics have become the social science of choice. And not only is it influencing people in undergrad institutions, it influences people on Wall Street and people in Washington. And our legal system is basically a translation of economic theory to contracts. So I think that the reason to call our field behavioral economics is just because economics has been so successful. And I think that what we want to do is to undermine this success and bring more realistic, evidence-based, empirical observation from social science into business, policy, and everyday life. If economic was not so successful, I don't think we would call it behavioral economics. I think, you know, maybe we'd call it applied social science or something else. But we are, I think it's more kind of a pedagogical, demagogical point of saying we want to stand in contrast to economics because people have such strong belief in economics. I mean, since Milton Friedman, if you think about it, and you ask people on the street what are their beliefs about how the world works, economics has really become almost like an intuitive theory of behavior. So it's almost like it's a practical reason, I think, that we call this field behavioral economics more than intellectual.
Okay. Well, moving in that direction, one of the things that you discuss in your book touches on a question that many of us have wrestled with, namely the huge bonuses that CEOs, investment bankers, and stockbrokers get, especially on the heels of the recent economic meltdown and bailout. So how does your research shed light on that?
Here is what happens. When you ask people, what is your intuition about the relationship between the amount of bonus and motivation and performance? They say, when you give me more money as a bonus, I will try harder. And because I'll try harder, I'll be more successful. So people think that bonus leads to motivation and motivation leads to success. And it turns out that that's correct when you deal with mechanical things. So for example, if I ask you to jump and I gave you a small bonus or a big bonus, as the size of the bonus increase, you'll jump many more times. So more bonus would lead to higher motivation, would lead to higher success. But it turns out that this intuition doesn't work as well for things that have to do with creativity and problem solving and memory and concentration, because on those things, we don't have the same level of control over our brains that we have over our muscles. And because of this, things can backfire. So, for example, imagine I told you that if you'll be really funny, if you'll tell me a really the most amazing new joke I've never heard before, and in the next 48 hours, I'll give you $100,000. You know, what could you control? You could spend, you could sleep less, you could drink more coffee, you could check Facebook less, email less, you'll be more hours at your desk. But the question is, aside from these things you can control, could you put yourself to a higher level of funniness? Could you push your brain into a higher level of creativity? And it turns out that this is where people where people fail. And I'll describe to you one experiment we've done is we took a group of people and we divide them into three groups. In group one, we said, hey, here are six tasks that require creativity and problem solving and concentration and memory. And if you do well on those six tasks, we'll give you one day of wages. If you do well on half, we'll give you half, a third, nothing, nothing. A second group of people, we said the same thing, but we said if you do well on those six tasks, we'll give you 2 weeks of wages. And the third group, we said we'll give you 5 months' salary. So the amount of bonus they could make varied between 1 day of salary to 2 weeks to 5 months. And what we found was that there was no difference between the 1 day and the 2 weeks. People worked as hard as they could, and increasing dramatically, the bonus did not increase their performance, but performance actually went down, and went down dramatically. In some tasks, it went down from people completing 40% of the task appropriately to about 4 or 5% of the times. And in a 5 months condition, things basically backfired in a really bad, really bad way. So...
Yeah, if the incentive gets too big, people can get very nervous, very anxious, right?
That's right. It turns out there's multiple mechanisms that work, and they all work in a negative way. So one thing is the anxiety and the focusing and the inability to concentrate. The other thing is just time. So imagine, you know, I went to talk to bankers in Wall Street, as you can imagine, and they don't like this result.
Right.
But... And they say that they don't get stressed and it never affects them. But what they admit is that, first of all, they talk about nothing else around the office but bonuses in October, November, and December. And they also admit that once a day, at least, they go into their desks, they open an Excel spreadsheet, and they try to calculate how much bonus they will get this year.
So they're wasting a lot of their time calculating their bonuses.
That's right. And you know, in many ways, it's obvious that they would do it, right? I mean, imagine that you got $5 million a year as average compensation, and 4 of it will be in a bonus. Wouldn't you be really curious about how much of it will be in a bonus this year, and wouldn't you calculate it every day to see how things change?
Yes, yes. Now, our listeners might think that you have a really large research grant that you could offer people, what was it, a 5 weeks vacation? This was one of the clever things, I thought, was that you conducted this research in India, where actually it was a small amount of money at the highest level, I think was $11 or something like that.
That's right. The per month expense is, expenditure is really, really low, so we could do it. But, you know, we also ran this experiment at MIT when people could get about $700 in 10 minutes.
Mm.
Now, it's not 5 months salary and it's not as much, but the results were basically the same. So I think it's much more general. You know, people sometimes say, oh, it just happened in India. No, it turns out it's not just India, and it turns out it's much more general.
Yes. Now, you also devised some clever experiments that support the notion that the meaningfulness of work might be more important than either high pay or big bonuses. Tell us a bit about what you did there.
Yeah, and this is an area which in many ways is kind of baffling about how primitive our thinking is, or how primitive is the thinking in the industry about it. So think about the question of why do people work? And it turns out that, you know, the answer people work for money is correct, but there's probably more than just that answer. But very few people would get you to recognize or think about the other reasons to work. And of course, you know, I'm not advocating that people should stop getting paid, or should people be just as happy if they lived in a cardboard box. People do need to get paid. But human motivation for labor are much more complex than just working for money. And when we think about how we motivate people, I think it's important to take this into account and say to ourselves, how do we motivate people? What else is missing? What would tilt the motivation equation? Now, in one particular experiment we did, which is the one you're referring to, is the question about meaning at work. And of course, there's lots of ways to think about meaning, and we thought about very, very tiny meaning. In fact, we thought about what happened when businesses eliminate meaning of work. And the way I started on this was that one day there was a student who came to my office. He was an ex-student. He left 2 or 3 years earlier, and he came to visit. And he told me a story about how he was working on a PowerPoint presentation for a merger, and he worked very hard for quite a few weeks on this PowerPoint presentation. And when he sent it to his boss said, "Oh, very nice, thank you for doing it. The merger is off." And the guy was completely devastated. And I started thinking about how will this look like? Here was a guy that, from a functional perspective, everything was good. His boss liked what he was doing. He enjoyed it as he was going along. But somehow, because he didn't think anybody would ever see it or appreciate it, there was very little meaning and value in what he was doing. So the experiment we did was very simple. We took Bionicles, which are little Lego robots, and we got people to build them. And we paid people on the diminishing wages. We paid them $3 for the first one, and $2.70 for the next, and $2.40 for the next, and so on. And in one condition, every time they finished one, we said, "Hey, do you want to build the next one for 30 cents less?" And they would say yes or no. And if they said yes, we will give them the next one, and they will build it. And as they would build it, we would take the one they just finished and put it under the table. And we told them that when they finish everything, we would take their Lego robots and we'll unassemble them and prepare them for the next participant. This was the first condition. In the second condition, imagine you were a subject, you are starting the first one, you finish the first one, you hand it to me. I ask you, do you want to build the second one? And if you say yes, I give you the second one, I take the first one, and as you build the second one, I unassemble it in real time. And then if you finished the second time and you want to build the second one, you want to build the third one, I give you the one that you built and I unassembled to build again. And we call this the Sisyphic task, right? Because of the Sisyphus, one of the interesting things about it is that he pushed a big rock up and down the same mountain. It wasn't down the different hills.
Right.
And two interesting things happened. First of all, people stopped working much faster, right? Even though it was, paper labor and so on, they stopped working much, much faster. And the second thing that happened that was very interesting was that the correlation between enjoyment of Lego and persistence in a task became zero. So think about it. You know, people vary on how much they love Legos, and presumably people who love Lego would want to do this task for longer, even if they didn't get paid that much, because they're enjoying the task. And for the first condition, what we call the meaningful condition, there was a really substantial correlation. People who liked Lego persisted much more than people who don't like Lego. But for the second condition, the Sisyphic condition, this correlation basically became zero. The people who liked Legos and the people did not like Lego did not differ in how long they persisted in the task. And what I think basically happened is that we were able to choke the joy out of people's enjoyment of Lego. We took whatever internal motivation they had, and we just completely eliminated that.
Yes.
And that of course, I think is incredibly sad. And I think it's incredibly sad because we do it all the time in business. I was in Seattle 3 weeks ago talking to a big software company. And there was a group of about 80 people in this software company who just worked for 2 years creating a new product for the company. And they thought this is the best new product out there. And they worked on it for 2 years, and the CEO looked at it and said, no, I'm canceling the project. And you couldn't believe how depressed, disappointed, kind of unhappy they were. And they basically told me that they just felt like they were in this Lego chapter.
Right, right.
Their boss, I mean, he could have canceled the projects in many different ways. But the way he decided to just close it and not do anything else with it left him completely uninterested, and of course created a big probability that they will just leave the company. And some of them were actually thinking about it, but it was really depressing.
Yeah, as a humanistically oriented psychologist, this is not too surprising to me. And I think it's in this chapter, this connection that you mentioned, Mike Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow. And I've been watching the positive psychology movement from the sidelines. You know, it's kind of like behavioral economics in that it's generating a lot of interesting research. How well does positive psychology interface with what you're finding and doing?
So I think in many ways, you know, positive psychology, I think, is really kind of just starting to become more interesting and more rigorous and more kind of penetrate life outside of, you know, small scale studies. And I think in many ways, the title, you know, of saying the upside of irrationality is a little bit influenced by positive psychology, which is to say, mm-hmm. there's lots of stuff that we do that it's not that people are wrong, it's that economic theory is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's true that we still look at irrationality and look at the bad sides of it, but there's also many aspects in which we should be grateful we're not rational. For example, imagine everybody around you was continuously trying to maximize their welfare, right? I mean, would you...
Dog eat dog?
Yeah, I mean, could you leave your door open to your car? Could you get somebody to help you cross the street? Could you get somebody to give you a dollar if you needed it? The truth is that while we make lots of unfortunate mistakes and the financial markets are evidence of this, we also are capable of tremendously wonderful things. And that's kind of part of the perspective that I'm hoping we'll start taking, is to not just say people are irrational, bad, 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 but to try and understand more deeply where we fail, where are the things that we need to fix, but also where are the things that we need to understand the wonderfulness of and why we violate. Why do we violate economic theory when it's appropriate to do it?
Okay. Now, you've done research on both personal attractiveness or beauty and also about the dating game and online dating. How did you come to study these? How did you study them, and what did you learn?
Oh, so there's a lot to say on online dating. So, you know, I think of myself as a social hacker. You know, I think of myself as somebody who's interested in practical problems in the world, and when I see something, I try to think about what's not going correctly, mm-hmm. and how can we solve it.
Yeah, that's a good description of what you do.
and for me, online dating or dating in general kind of looked like a really bad market. So, you know, I look at it from the perspective of being a graduate student or a young faculty, and it looked like it's really hard to match people in the dating market. Now, it used to be that there was a yente, there used to be that parents used to match their kids. In some sense, this would help the problem. But over time, these market solutions have disappeared, and they've disappeared with the idea that everybody should find their own love. And it turns out that that's very, very hard very hard to do, and people were just not good at it. On top of that, Americans move great distances for school, for the first job, the second job, the third job. People work many hours. Romantic engagement at the workplace are not favorable. So you're really left with the situation. If you're a young person working in the U.S., it's very hard for you to find anything. So online dating looked like a wonderful solution for this social problem and a much needed approach. But if you just start looking at online dating, you would very quickly realize that this is very far from any kind of wonderful solution. That in fact it has lots and lots of problems. And here is kind of one intuitive way to think about it. Imagine that I said, give me names of 50 people you really like and 50 people you like only so-so. And now I will go to these 100 people and I will ask each of them to fill an online panel, an online description of themselves. And this will not include their name and will not include their picture, but include all the other attributes that online dating sites are using. And then I'll come back and I'll give you the 100 profiles. And I will say, now please sort them into two piles. The piles of people you like and the piles of people you don't like. How good do you think you'll be in that? And it turns out you'll probably be about random. Because really? The way that online websites describe people is incredibly not useful, right? And basically what happened is that online dating sites are trying to take people and make them into digital cameras. They're trying to take people and describe them along dimensions that are easy for computers and, you know, programmers to comprehend. You know, so what's your zoom and pixels and megapixels and the aperture and so on. And while these things are easy to describe, it turns out they are not very useful. Instead, people are much more like wine, where it's hard to figure out why we like a specific wine. But it's all about the taste, and it's all about when you taste it, do you like it or not? Now, it doesn't offer immediately an easy solution for people who are running online dating sites, but it just says that the problem is that if we describe products in ways that are incompatible with how people process information, we're not going to get very far. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, you also studied speed dating, and so I'm wondering, does speed dating solve the problem because people at least get to see each other face-to-face rather than having to rely just on a strictly quantitative approach?
Yeah, so speed dating is a much improvement. I mean, you know, it takes more time to get there and so on, but on average, if people go and meet 20 people in a speed dating event, there's a good chance that they'll have 3 or 4 dates out of that. Whereas if you go on online dating and you write 100 people, there's not a good chance you'll have 3 or 4 dates out of that. So speed dating and the immediacy and the feedback that you get from people and the non-intermediate communication actually works much better in terms of probability of getting, going for coffee.
But still not a perfect solution, right?
Well, you know what they say, perfect is the enemy of the good.
Okay.
I think it's in the right direction. So, but what we tried to do in our approach was we tried to create virtual dating. We said, let's take a step back and let's look at what dating is all about. and what is dating? It's not that you and I sit in a room and, you know, talk about the weather or how many brothers and sisters you have. Instead, dating is about experiencing something together. And that I get to see how you behave with the waitress and music and art and whatever it is. And we said, maybe it's this non-direct interaction that actually gives people some feeling about the other person. And if this is the case, would it make sense to create something that was much more like that, that was much more like experiencing something together. So we create this virtual dating site in which you could go and do stuff with people. You enter this space and there was music and there was art and there was all kinds of things. And you could text people and there was discussions about stuff. And without going into details of the experiment, we basically double the probability of having a second date after. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually, you know, I think there's kind of, you know, it's kind of good news, bad news. We can analyze and see how bad things are being done, but we can also see how easy it is to fix things. And sadly enough, with relatively little investment, we could make the websites much, much better.
Great. Now, in this context, you also studied and discussed attractiveness and beauty and so on. And you touch again on the fact that when you were 18 years old, you were scarred by burns over 70% of your body. And one of the most moving parts of the book, both moving and difficult to read, and way more difficult to experience, I'm sure. You describe that moment as an 18-year-old when you first look into a mirror in the hospital and the shock and horror of your damaged body and the impact on your self-image. And of course, the good story, you know, leaping ahead, is that you've been married for 15 years to a beautiful woman and you've got two kids. I'm wondering, as a psychologist, did you have any counseling or psychotherapy to help you with your self-image?
So I had the psychotherapy early on. Mostly what I got out of this is some strategies for auto-suggestions and kind of calming down that were incredibly, incredibly helpful, particularly because, you know, the heat it's very hard to deal with the heat when you have most of your body doesn't perspire. So being able to calm your body down is very important. I got a lot out of this. In terms of body image, you know, I had kind of a strange reaction to it. For example, you know, I don't really know how to analyze dreams, but When I just got injured, my dreams were basically unaffected by my injury. Later on, I was dreaming about myself in the hospital environment, so with different apparatuses and different treatments, but I did not have scars. And later on, I just stopped dreaming about myself. So I haven't dreamed about myself for a long time, or at least I don't see myself in my dreams. So in some sense, I think that it's surprising how difficult it is to get used to this new body image. And sure. You know, when I walk on the street and I walk by a big glass that looks kind of like a mirror and I see myself, it's surprising to me every time. So it's amazing how I haven't gotten used to this. To this body. And I don't look at myself too much, so it's...
Yeah. So what do you think got you through? I mean, you know, even though that's the case, it seems to me that there's a way in which you've made a remarkable recovery from this horrible experience. Psychologically, what do you think got you through?
So you know, the question of resilience is a question I think that you don't understand much and who is more successful and less successful. But I have to admit that in the beginning... I went through because I didn't understand how bad it was. Right, I was. If you put me again in this situation and you say, Dan, imagine that you got injured today and you have these 3 years in hospital ahead of you. Do you want to continue and you just want to terminate your life? I will just say let's end it here. Wow. I would say it's not worth it.
Right.
But in the beginning, I didn't really understand how bad it was and how unrecoverable the situation is. You know, we all have burns as kids and they all go away. And I thought about my burns as burns like that. I didn't understand that extensive burns of the level and amount that I had just don't go away, right? The skin never get healed in the same way, and that it's not just the skin, it's the bones, it's blood supply, I mean, it's tendons, it's a lot of things under the under the skin. So I think in the beginning it was just lack of knowledge.
Ignorance is bliss. Well, not bliss, but it helped to get you through.
That's right. And actually one of the most difficult psychological periods were when I realized, as I was getting better, and I realized that how long the struggle would be. You know, I think depressed people often have this experience where they are depressed, they don't do anything bad. It's only when they get out of depression, they realize how bad it was and then try and terminate their lives. And for me, the same thing happened when the critical period was over, when I was no longer in danger of losing my life, and I was getting to be better, and only then I realized what a long road I had in front of me. That was actually quite a depressing and difficult time.
Well, I can imagine. Well, let me switch ground a bit here. Dan, as you know, I'm also a qualitative market research consultant.
Yep.
And I saw on your blog that you have some criticisms of focus groups, but rather than debating that, I'm wondering what the implications of behavioral economics might be for market research.
Yeah, so you know, I you wrote me about this thing. You know, I looked a little bit after our initial email. You know, it's amazing how little research there is comparing focus group to other research methods about when they're better and when they're worse. It's really kind of amazing, especially if you think about how much money goes into research. So understanding exactly under what circumstances are focus group more useful, under what circumstances are worse, I think is incredibly important. But I'll tell you more generally that I think the research shows quite convincingly that there are many areas in life in which people's intuitions about their behavior are off. So, and this kind of fits with lots of social psychology, which is saying when you ask people why they behave the way they do, people are fantastic in giving us stories, but they're often just stories. And the question is, how much do you want to emphasize and make conclusion based on these stories? And so the first issue would be that if people's intuition are off, then we don't want to do focus group, which we rely on their intuitions. That, I think, is the first part. The second part is that there's a question of what people use as convincing evidence. And we know, for example, from something called the identifiable victim effect, is that when you present people with a story about one single girl, their emotion gets activated and they start caring. When you present statistical data, people don't seem to care as much. And I think the same thing happened in research. So if I did some research project and I showed you that 78% of the people do X, so I told you that out of 500 people, 300 of them show this tendency, I think from a persuasive perspective, it's less powerful than saying John, who was person number 4 in the focus group, said that he loved these genes because of reason X. Right? So I think there's kind of two issues here. One is how much do you want to trust intuition, and the second thing is how useful do people find different types of data as a persuasive technique. And I suspect that focus groups are really good as a persuasive technique, and because of that, they have kind of enjoyed the longevity of being around for such a long time.
Well, you know, I would, as I say, I didn't really want to debate the efficacy of focus groups. Market researchers are well aware that they need to listen beneath the surface and that the reasons that people give aren't always accurate, as you may or may not be aware. In addition to focus groups, we do one-on-one in-depth interviews. We use projective tests. We use homework assignments. We do on-site ethnographic observations. We do shop-alongs and so on. And it's not all consumer research. Much of it is business to business. But my real question for you was, okay, I'm a market researcher. You're in this other field of behavioral economics. Are there some tools or techniques that I could add to my kit bag that would help me to do effective market research? How might behavioral economics give me some new tools, some new leverage?
Okay, so I'm not sure if this is behavioral economics, but one of the most interesting developments recently has been markets for information. And I don't know if you followed like the Iowa presidential market, for example, or the Hollywood Stock Exchange.
No.
It turns out that there are, so focus group people talk to each other. In markets for information, people bid on different things. So, for example,
yes. Okay, now I know what you're talking about.
So, in the Iowa presidential market, people have every day they had a stock value for how much the option for Obama is worth and how much the option for McCain is worth, and he thought that Obama was overpriced, you would sell Obama. If you thought McCain was overpriced, you would sell McCain, and the other way around. And it turns out that those techniques of markets for information, where people participate only when they think they have to add something, where some money is at stake, and where the aggregation is not done on individual level but at the market level, turns out to be very, very effective techniques. So I think if you looked for one big technique, I think this would be the main one that, you know, again, it comes from a combination of things, but I think that's a very useful one. Another thing I would caution about, actually, I don't know if I caution about. So another important aspect is that once people say an idea, even if it's a random idea, they fall in love with it. And I'm sure you've seen that in different meetings.
Sure.
Right, somebody says some random comments, and all of a sudden they fall in love with it, and in some sense it's a really good tendency, because you know this is how you can get graduate students to work really long hours on trying to pursue a project they came up with randomly, and they're really committed to it. And the other hand, you want to try and figure out how do these ideas fall away from and compare to other ideas that maybe somebody else came up with. And I think that's kind of a real struggle for people who lead. Focus group is how do you get people to not commit to ideas because they are theirs.
Okay, well, you did research, you know, that was critical of online dating, finding that filling out forms, basically a quantitative approach, doesn't begin to tap into the richness of being physically present with another person.
That's right.
So let me ask you to do a thought experience, experiment. I'm wondering if you were to gather a group of people together who had done online dating and get them together in a group to discuss their experience, do you think you might have some fresh insights or some fresh ideas to investigate?
I think you would. So, you know, this is not to say that listening to other people is useless.
Good. Right? Right.
So, but let's separate two things. Let's separate what it means to us experts in the field to tell me what their experience is and what their barriers are and so on. And that's very useful, right?
Yes.
So, you know, if I don't date as much, it's good to know people who are dating, and people who use this site might know something that people. This is about gathering data. But what worries me is user focus group is a mechanism to try and find out reasons and solutions. Right? So talking to people is good. Learning is always useful. You can learn from anybody. What worries me is that you're going to use focus groups. And again, I don't want to talk about all the other things because there's lots of, you know, observational stuff and so on.
Right.
But when you ask people about their reasons of why they're acting in a certain way, I think that's a particularly problematic thing. So collecting data is good, but asking people to come up with solution or to tell you what solution would work the best and so on, I wouldn't do it that way. So maybe the way we can resolve it is that I think we both agree that talking to people can be incredibly useful in kind of early stages formulating ideas.
Okay, good. I'll accept that.
I think what we need to think more carefully, it's what's good at later stages once you want to propose mechanisms or you want to test the efficacy of some mechanisms and whether focus group would be useful under those conditions. And I think not so. But I'll tell you what, I'm actually going to this weekend try and think about how would you test this? How would you test what focus groups versus other methods could be useful for?
You know, I think that research is out there, but I don't know where it is, so I can't refer you to it, but it seems to me that I have heard of this sort of research. How does your work, if at all, how does your work on irrationality overlap or intersect with psychoanalytic ideas about the unconscious?
Cool. Listen, so first of all, this is a very tough question. And I think, thankfully, I have to run to another meeting.
Oh, no.
I have another meeting at 4 and I have to run.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to lose you. And I want to thank you so much for being my guest.
My pleasure. It was really nice talking to you. I hope we'll get to do it again.
I hope you found this interview with Dan Ariely as stimulating as I did. It's unfortunate that he had to cut it short, but I should be quick to say that it wasn't Dan's fault. We were having some problems with Skype and got disconnected in the middle of the interview, and we lost time getting our connection reestablished. As a consequence, I didn't make it to several questions I wanted to finish with. The last one about any possible connection between his notion of, quotes, irrationality and the psychoanalytic conception of the unconscious was a particularly important one, however. Also, I really wanted to get to that question because it had been submitted by my friend and recent guest and Irish psychoanalyst Paul Moore. I emailed Dan with a request that we record an answer to that question, which I would then splice into the interview, but he has too much else on his plate and declined, and I can understand that. Having read his book, though, I think I can take a stab at his position on irrationality as he means it and the Freudian idea of the unconscious. I think the kind of irrationality that he's talking about is quite different from the sort that Freud talks about. The key notion in Freudian theory is that the unconscious is not merely material that is out of awareness, but more importantly, it is material that is out of awareness because it would be threatening to the ego. In other words, it's closely related to inner conflicts, psychological defenses, traumas, and so on. Consequently, Freud's unconscious would suggest contents that are unique to the individual. The sort of irrationality that Dan is referring to is more generic. He's referring to specific perceptual and cognitive biases that are pretty much common to us all. For example, on page 285 of his book, The Upside of Irrationality, he discusses what he now regards as the irrational reasons why he chose not to have his arm amputated after the damage from the fiery explosion. His rational surgeons urged the amputation, and looking back now, he regrets his own irrational decision as a youngster not to have it amputated. He describes three irrational biases in this regard. First is what he calls the endowment effect, and refers to a tendency to overvalue what we already have. Second, he refers to loss aversion. He says, quotes, losses are psychologically painful, and accordingly, we need a lot of extra motivation to be willing to give something up, end quote. Third, he mentions what he calls the human quirk of avoiding irreversible decisions. About this, he says, making regular choices is hard enough, but making irreversible decisions is especially difficult. He also mentions something he calls the sunk cost fallacy in relation to why he doesn't get his arm amputated now, given that he now realizes that it would have been a wise choice and that he's in constant pain from that arm. Having put up with the pain and invested in various ways of adapting to that arm, it's hard for him to change the decision. In other words, the sunk cost refers to the difficulty of shifting from a decision in which there's already been considerable investment of time, energy, money, or other resources. He goes on to say, quote, it is very difficult to make really big, important, life-changing decisions because we're all susceptible to a formidable array of decision biases. There are more of them than we realize, and they come to visit us more often than we like to admit, end quote. So from these passages, I think it's pretty clear that what he's talking about is quite different than the Freudian unconscious. I definitely recommend his book to any of you who are intrigued by what you've heard here. He also has an impressive presentation on TED.com at www.ted.com where you can see a video. And he has a very lively and provocative blog at http://danariely.com. Dan Ariely is spelled D-A-N-A-R-I-E-L-Y. And on his blog, he has a variety of perceptual illusions and short questionnaires that allow you to test your own irrationalities. Hello, all you Shrink Wrap Radio fans. I really appreciate your listening to these podcasts. I'll keep this part short and sweet. I've got a new interview up at wisecounselpodcast.com, and it's with Dr. Wilma Bucci on psychoanalysis and cognitive science. She's done really important theoretical work reframing and updating psychoanalytic concepts in the light of contemporary psycholinguistics and cognitive science. She'll definitely give your brain a good workout. If by any chance you're listening to this podcast and you're not subscribed, please do so. It costs you nothing, and it does help me to track how many listeners I have. There's a link on our site which will help you to subscribe in iTunes. I'd like to remind you that there is a Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook fan page now. This is in addition to our Yahoo discussion group, and I know some people like Yahoo discussion groups and others prefer to chat on Facebook. So if you're already on Facebook, you can find our fan page by simply typing Shrink Wrap Radio into the search area at the top of the page. Or if you go to shrinkwrapradio.com, you'll see a new Facebook icon in the right-hand sidebar, and clicking on that will get you to our fan page. There's also an icon there for the Yahoo discussion group, which you're welcome to join as well. Now, the most recent transcript added to the Shrink Wrap Radio website is number 232, Mindfulness and the Art of Choice with Karen Sherman, Ph.D. And I want to thank Kirsten Pettifor for her volunteer work in doing this transcription. In fact, most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free. Thanks to all the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides incredible value, in my opinion, and I'm always looking for new transcribers to help us keep up. So please contact me if you'd be interested in being a volunteer transcriber. And let me remind you to visit our Shrink Wrap Radio store, where you'll find T-shirts with the Shrink Wrap Radio logo, as well as archival CDs and links to my two online continuing ed courses, Wisdom of the Dream and the other on positive psychology. As I've said before, Shrink Wrap Radio is largely a labor of love. I do put a lot of time into each episode. It's a lot more time-consuming than is probably apparent. Your donations do help to keep my motivation alive in this sixth year of the podcast. And thanks to the one person who sent in a fresh donation since the last show, and also to several continuing donors. Your contributions are greatly appreciated. So if you've been thinking about making a donation but haven't gotten around to it, despite what I say at the end of each show, don't let it be all in your mind. Just look for the big green donate button on the Shrink Wrap Radio site.
Hi, this is Houston-based union analyst and author James Hollis, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. James Hollis, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from a listener and potential transcriptionist who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I have enjoyed many of your podcasts. I heard you on a recent podcast ask for volunteer transcribers. I'm not actually a transcriber, with the correct equipment, but I do edit and proofread in American English for two large companies. I freelance from home as I have young children. If I can help out by transcribing an interview for you, please do not hesitate to contact me. I edit medical and life science research and have a basic knowledge of psychology, so I'm sure I could manage if it is at all possible to just transcribe from your podcasts. Regards and thanks for all the fascinating interviews. And that's from Poppy. And Poppy, thank you so much for that offer. And I did contact Poppy, and Poppy has agreed to take on number 162 with Ted Zeff on the highly sensitive person. So I'm really looking forward to that. It was good to hear again from Francisco in Buenos Aires, who responded to my reading of his last email on the air. And he writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I really appreciate your commenting on my email on your show. Psychoanalysis is indeed very popular among the middle and upper classes here in Argentina, especially in Buenos Aires and other large urban areas. I believe your podcast series is an important and accessible resource for psychologists in the making, such as myself. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners are enriched by your and some of your guests' insights, wisdom, and experience. It is, in my view, certainly a compliment and an expansion on the overwhelmingly Freudian/Lacanian theory we learn here at university and get at therapy when we can afford the sessions. I hope you keep the interviews coming for a long time. I'll also be looking forward to the possibility of a show on liberation social psychology. If you ever take the plunge and fly to Argentina and feel like it, there will be some people here eager to meet you. Best, Francisco." Francisco, thank you so much for that, and what a generous offer. And I have to say, I've hesitated. I'd like to go to Buenos Aires, but it seems like it's such a long flight. But your generous offer, or I don't know whether to call it an offer, but a suggestion that there'd be people there who'd be happy to see me, boy, that certainly does put some fire under my motivation. So I've put your email address in my address book as somebody to contact if I'm going down that way. Finally, we hear again from Peter B. Todd, my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 240 about unconscious mental factors in HIV. And Peter writes, "Dear David, congratulations upon such an enlightening interview with Nancy Ferlotti on the Red Book, which seems to carry listeners into the extraordinary phenomenology and journey into the unconscious of Carl Jung. Whatever attributions of psychotic phenomena or, quotes, madness have been made historically in ad hominem attempts to discredit this visionary and prophetic pioneer in the exploration, especially of the collective unconscious, the interview has, I believe, contributed to Jung's rehabilitation and restoration to his rightful place in the history of ideas as well as depth psychology. With respect to the archetypes, Jung's collaboration with the Nobel laureate in physics Wolfgang Pauli in formulating the synchronicity principle is perhaps not as widely known as Jung's other volumes. Jung and Pauli referred to the archetypes as, quotes, timeless cosmic regulating and ordering principles, close quotes, whose psychic, mental, and material manifestations stood in a relationship of complementarity to one another. Rather than reducibility of mind to matter, which would eliminate a dual aspect solution to the psychophysical problem, one which Pauli regarded as one of the greatest challenges of contemporary humanity. As Nancy implies, many of Jung's insights were remarkably prescient concerning the destructiveness of humankind's collective shadow. Listeners might be interested in exploring these insights in K.V. Laurie Kainen's book, Beyond the Atom, The Philosophic Thought of Wolfgang Pauli. That's a 1985 book by Springer Verlag. Please keep these engaging podcasts going. They are significant contributions to knowledge which might not otherwise be available to many people. Kind regards, Peter B. Todd. And Peter, thank you for that support. So I think that'll wrap it up for today. Remember to send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. I'd love to get a voicemail, and you can call me at 206-337-0622. Thanks to psychologist and behavioral economist Dr. Dan Ariely for sharing his work with us. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Houston-based Jungian analyst and author Dr. James Hollis, and we'll be talking about the middle passage of life. And I'm sure you'll find it fascinating. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.